Hey folks, it's Steve Wiest here again with another episode of the Leadology Podcast. That's right, we're back. And the mission of the podcast, what is the mission, you might ponder and query? Well, the mission is this. It's all about trombonists talking to trombonists about trombone. Anything better than that? Well, there might be something better. How about a high D flat? Get it? Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's that dog flat. You know I love me some D flat. Hey, well, along with that, our guest artist for this episode is the magnificent Carol Jarvis. She's just a delight to speak with, and I think you're really going to enjoy our conversation. We had a blast. Carol is a stellar trombonist. She plays all the keyboards. She programs sounds on the keyboards. She's a voiceover artist, a symphony trombonist, plays tenor, bass trombone, euphonium, bass trumpet, my goodness, even some timpani, as we found out. She's the president of the International Trombone Association, former president of the British Trombone Society. She's busy. Oh my goodness, she's busy. And we found out, good news, she's going to be the president of ITA for a couple more years now before my pal Dave Begnosh takes over. So that's good news. We get into a lot of things talking about a great many aspects of the world of Carol Jarvis, one of which is her unbelievable struggle with the dreaded cancer Hodgkin's lymphoma and how she has dealt with that over the years. It's an incredible story, and I think one very worthwhile of you going to check out her podcast. It's called In My Veins, and you can get it anywhere where podcasts are available. And I highly recommend that you check it out. We talk a little bit about it here, but she gives the whole amazing story at her podcast. So, you know, it's time to get on with the show. And without further ado, let's go talk to the wonderful Carol Jarvis. Look, everybody, it's Carol Jarvis. How you doing? Welcome.
Thank you very much. This is an absolute honor, so thank you.
Oh, my goodness. It's our pleasure and honor. And you are quite definitely the hardest working person in show business, as we were we've discussed. And congratulations. Also, you are responsible for an entire legion of angels getting their wings, as I also mentioned. All the great things that you do, and the great things that happen to you too, as well as all the epic stuff. And we could speak for 5 hours. I don't think you can do that. So we've got an hour, and so I've organized things a bit here. I think, you know, and then we don't have to follow this plan. But here's what I thought we'd start with is from the very beginning. And start from the beginning we did, but here I am post-production jumping in to let you know that Carol's doggy started making some noise and she had to get up and close the door. And now back to the action.
Sorry, I've got a very noisy little dog.
Oh, we just rescued a 10-month-old golden retriever.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, so she might be barking at some point too. What is your little doggy?
I've got a miniature schnauzer called Henry, and he seems to hear a car door slamming three streets away and it goes crazy.
Yes, they are very adept that way. We are in a townhouse in a large building, and here in Chicago in the U.S., and so we have somebody right across the hallway. Whenever that person comes in, our dog, whose name is Phoebe, just goes crazy. Yeah. So... I say, oh, please don't bark anymore. So anyway, well, here's my organization starting from the beginning. And look here, I've got notes, a book of notes, to seem as if I'm organized and intelligent. But being a trombonist, I'm neither. But Carol's story, you begin. Northampton, grew up in Buckinghamshire. But music, when did that begin? Did it start at the what is now Milton Keynes? Is that how you pronounce it?
Milton Keynes, yeah.
Milton Keynes. Yes. Or was it before that? Or when did music start for Carol?
I think I've got an older brother, and he was very much very musical from the word go. He started playing the cello, I think, when he was about 5 or 6. And the norm when you're about 4 or 5 was we took up the little recorder at school. Yep. And so every classroom was full of like 30 kids all playing recorders.
And that's a wonderful sound.
I can imagine. Thankfully, I don't remember. I took to the recorder. It was very easy. And I guess with music in the family, it kind of became quite naturally to me. And then I had a go at the clarinet. Didn't really like it. I took up classical guitar when I was about 9, I think. So I played classical guitar for a little bit, and but it still wasn't my instrument. It wasn't, I didn't totally love it. And then there was some music tests at school. And I remember we all spread out, sat on the floor in the assembly hall, and they played lots of clips, and you had to write down whether the note was higher or lower, whether it was sharper or flatter. And there were some tests that way, and the results came back saying that I scored the top in the whole group. And they said, right, you can choose any instrument. We'd like you to take up the oboe because we don't have an oboe in the school orchestra. So I went home and asked my parents, what's an oboe? And they played me some recordings, and apparently I said, no way. and apparently I just said to my dad, what's the instrument with the slidey arm thing? Ooh. I just said that to my dad. So I didn't know where I'd seen it before. And so that was a trombone. Let's play you some recordings. So they played me all sorts of recordings, some brass bands, orchestras, jazz stuff. And I went, yeah, that's what I want.
How cool is that? So
I don't know where I'd seen it. So my dad got hold of a trombone, and I absolutely loved it. And I know there was, I think, to begin with, it's normally a 20-minute lesson with 2 other people. So it's not like a one-to-one lesson when you first start. So I was with a cornet teacher with 2 cornet players, and one of my really, really good old friends that I'm still in touch with today, he actually was in the background in the room witnessing my first lesson. And he said, I turned up to my first lesson playing a whole scale. And he said, normally people are struggling to produce a note.
Right. You were ready to go.
Yeah, I was playing a scale. So, and I was taught by cornet teachers right up until grade 8. So I was learning from all the trumpet method books and all the vowel fingerings above the notes.
Didn't
have slide positions. It's all.
Well, this explains a couple of things. I mean, your adeptness with euphonium as well as trombone, as well as not being afraid of the upper register. I mean, you heard trumpets, so those notes probably sounded correct, you know, when you played them on trombone.
Yeah, I think the high register is that's where I feel most at home. I've actually just finished doing 2 weeks on bass trombone, doing a string of gigs and radio stuff, and so that I had to practice. Whenever I have to play bass trombone, I have to do a bit of practice.
Pedal notes are my enemies. I just have to play those all the time to get even close. But yeah, listening to your upper register, that makes sense that you heard trumpet first off. And it's very cool that you also have guitar. That would come in handy for songwriting. So you could be the next Paul McCartney or something if you wanted to be. Right.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, I've got a couple of guitars. I've got a bass guitar and a beautiful acoustic guitar.
Nice.
But yeah, I don't really have time to play anymore.
Yeah, I'll bet. I bet you have time for very little. I mean, and also a huge amount of stuff. Well, how did the, let's jump ahead a little bit. How did the, see, I'm going to be very hip here and just use the acronym. Your journey to RNCM, how did you get there?
That is the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester.
Yes, for the listeners.
Yeah, so I was studying English, theatre studies, and music at school.
Wow,
in my
cool.
last few years, because I found music very easy, but I wanted to go into sort of presenting and the media side of things. That was what I wanted to do. So, hence the English and the theatre, and I had to drop English sadly because I was too busy with the music, and there was literally no way I could keep up with reading all the books.
You're doing very, very well with English. I think so. You're okay.
So unfortunately I had to drop that subject. So I did music and theatre studies, and I got the highest marks possible for both of them. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. My brother had gone to a music conservatoire in the UK, and I thought, well, maybe I'll do the auditions around all the music conservatoires. So there's probably about four or five conservatoires in London, one in Birmingham, one in Manchester, one in Scotland.
Right.
So I thought I'd audition for most of them. And I just found it easy. It was my hobby. So I thought, well, I'll just see how I get on. And I got offered a place everywhere. And it was just, well, maybe I might do this then. I'll give it a go. And I didn't want to study in London, even though that's basically where I work now, with all the West End shows and the orchestras. But I didn't want to study there. I thought there's a lot of professional orchestras, but there's a lot of conservatoires as well. Whereas in Manchester, there's one music conservatoire with four or five professional orchestras. So the chance of freelancing straight away is much, much higher. And I actually started picking up professional work from my first year. So I was I was doing some professional work before I went to study at the conservatoire. Dipping for my teacher who was touring with the Spice Girls and Madness. He was doing all the pop stuff. So I ended up dipping for him.
Connections. You had connections right away. That's great.
Yeah. So wow. I was doing some dips for him on some jazz gigs and little combo gigs and rehearsals for him before I went to college. And then in my first year at the conservatoire, I started freelancing with the Halle Orchestra, the BBC Philharmonic. And it just built up from there, and I didn't realize at the time that's quite unusual.
It is.
I'm now a professor of trombone at the RNCM.
Right. As well as Trinity. How do you pronounce the second name in that?
Trinity Laban. Yeah.
Laban. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is in London. I'm not really teaching there very much anymore. There's not as many trombone students there at the moment. So, the RNCM is a very, very big department. So, and I coach the pop, on the, they've got a session orchestra and a pop course up there. So I do a lot of coaching with that as well. So,
That sounds exciting. And I heard you mention somewhere that another aspect of the Royal College was that you enjoyed the diversity of offerings, like so many different. Were you always kind of eclectic with music and art and just everything's music and there was no silos?
I think it was because it was influenced from my trombone teacher. It was cornet teachers up to grade 8, and then the cornet teacher said, well, we need to try and find a trombone teacher at least to get you through your grade 8 before you might go on and study to music conservatoire. So they found a trombone teacher, and obviously he was touring with the Spice Girls, and we'd go through all the classical repertoire and we'd be learning all the concertos and things, but he'd say, let's do a blues, and he'd sit down at the piano and just start jam along. So I was really, really influenced by him and the music service in Milton Keynes at the time. We had Saturday mornings that were started off at 8:30 in the morning with composition classes. Programming keyboards and learning about arpeggiators and chord sequences. And then that moved on to a piano lesson then. And then I had brass bands, orchestras, and finishing off at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon with big band and improvisation classes. So the music service was unbelievable. And then Monday evenings was another orchestra. Tuesday evenings was brass band. Wednesday evenings was my trombone lesson and brass quintet. Thursday evenings was chamber choir. And Friday evenings was chamber orchestra. And I was playing timpani in the chamber orchestra. Went on tour with the chamber orchestra playing timps.
No way. Wow. Yeah.
And then all day Saturday was the main time. So it was kind of, it was such a busy time growing up. Hence, I had to drop a subject because I couldn't keep up.
Right. And all of that was before college.
Yeah.
Incredible.
I found the RNCM had a big band, it had a brass band, had several orchestras, a composition, jazz classes. It was everything. So I thought, this is the place for me.
Yeah, you had to go there. Anything else would be a step down. You were so used to all the eclectic stuff. That is spectacular. What a great education. It's very understanding. That's, you know, the proverbial toss a match into a pool of gasoline. I mean, when you have talent and you're given that, it's of course you're going to catch fire.
Yeah, I just didn't want to stop doing one of them. And I know some some students these days are, they're on the classical course, but they say, right, I'm going to go and study on the jazz course. I don't want to do classical anymore. But if you can do both, do both, because there's more doors that can be opened to you then. And you never know where that first phone call is going to come from.
Absolutely.
And where it's going to lead. So, and that's kind of what I did. And it's worked out, Dutchwood.
Yes. You are ahead of the curve. That seems to be in the 21st century these days, that it's almost a necessity. You have to really cover all the bases if you want to freelance.
A lot of students want to be session musicians. And I say to them, well, you need to be able to play in every style. You need to be able to sight read in every single style. And some of them might not be enjoying the sort of the Baroque side of things, but I'm like, you've got to do it.
Yep. Have to be ready for that. And then you have to be ready. Hey, can you be there at 8 o'clock and it's bass trombone? Oh, well, I don't play bass trombone. Okay. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, I'd get phone calls at 7 o'clock in the evening saying, can you get here for a 7:30 concert?
Oh,
principal trombone, Halle Orchestra. I was like, okay, I'm on my way. And I didn't even think about asking what the program is. And I turn up and it's Brahms 1. So that's fine. I know it. That's fine. I can do that.
You get to do the hymn in the middle that comes out of nowhere. It's such
beautiful.
And at the end of it, where that theme comes back at the end of the whole piece. Oh, I get chills just thinking about that.
Yeah.
Oh,
that was just incredible. But I'd get so many sort of last minute calls. And if you get known as being someone reliable that can there at the drop of a hat, then it's always going to snowball from there.
Oh, man. Okay. Everybody listening to this, write that. I hope you're taking notes. Write that down. That's pearls of wisdom right there. Pearls of wisdom indeed. And here we are, post-production. It's time for a commercial. It's time to talk about our one and only sponsor. Oh man, you know, Carol has a sponsor in her podcast, Shure Microphones. Man. Well, we got one sponsor, and it happens to be me. And it happens to be the book Leadology, which I wanted to take a moment to talk about. And suggest that you go to leadtrombone.com, LEADTROMBONE.com, and go to the shop tab, SHOP, and pick up a book. Leadology Volume 1 comes as a PDF that you can get right away, or in a couple of days, you can. When you order it, it'll come to you in a couple of days as a physical book, which I highly recommend. I'm an analog kind of guy and enjoy the book in physical form that you can open up, set on your music stand, and it's wire bound. It's well done. Very, very well printed. Fine product. And what's in that product? Oh, it's all the fun stuff to get you started on the wonderful road of learning to play lead trombone. And if you're already a lead trombonist, I think it'll help quite a bit with improving that game. Everything from warm-ups, lip slurs, air efficiency exercises and discussion through legato etudes that have marvelous backing tracks. The great rhythm section of Dave Bayless on drums, Joey Scoach on piano, and Dennis Carroll on bass. Great fun to play, and they're progressive. They get more and more difficult and challenging, and they help you learn the upper register and how to be relaxed and to play that efficiently. Also in the book, there's analysis of lead parts, discussion of the acquisition of style and jazz syntax, a listening page people to listen to. There's even a syllabus for a semester of study. So, man, and I'm leaving out the best part. That's the cartoons. Over 30 cartoons and illustrations that help you get through the day as well as enjoy the book. So, leadtrombone.com and pick one up today. Well, let's continue on here with the history of Carroll. So, was Michael Bolton then the first big road trip, or did you go out with somebody earlier than that?
I was doing all sorts of little function things, lots of big band work, and I think the first sort of pop side of things, I did some touring with Roy Wood, who wrote "Oh, I Wish It Could Be Christmas."
Oh, right.
Yeah. And we played that all year round. That was his biggest song. So he did Blackberry Way. There were all sorts of some fantastic songs, and he was in Wizard and ELO as well. So there were some great tunes there. We did a lot of touring with Roy. The Michael Bolton gig came about because there was a trumpet player and a saxophone player. They needed a female horn section because they needed female vocals. And they needed a female trombone player, and they didn't know one. So my name apparently was thrashed around by various people recommending me. So they got in touch with me, and I met them on the plane on the way to South Africa on the way to the first tour.
How exciting. And was that your first time on that continent, that far away from UK and all of the...
Yeah, so I've done all sorts of touring before, but South Africa, that was my one and only time I've toured there, actually.
Yeah. Wow. That's so exciting. Well, I've got a short list of some of the people you've played with. Once again, we could speak for 4 hours just talking about the folks you've played with. But I wanted to know how they were to work with, and also how often was it actually a horn section, or were you playing keyboards or writing or both or all of the above? So Michael Bolton, we get to learn about that. And this will be the first plug and pitch that I make for your podcast on this show. Everybody must check out In My Veins, a Carroll Jarvis podcast. And just, you know, go through all six parts of episode one. That has to be a movie or a book or something soon, a streaming series. It's the most incredible story I've ever heard. So, but anyway, in that podcast, you talk a lot about how wonderful Michael was to work with, like a family. And was he a good leader? And
just amazing. I mean, I had cancer when I joined the tour. But it didn't faze anyone. And it is exactly what you kind of need when you're dealing with such a huge event in your life. You need an escape, and you need a focus elsewhere. Otherwise you can just get all consumed with having cancer.
And that was with Michael Bolton, that was the beginning of that epic journey. That's when you first found out about it.
Yeah, so 2004 I was diagnosed, and I started touring with Michael Bolton in 2006.
Oh, okay. So you'd already been.
Yeah, so I was already had a lot of back-to-back treatments. But they welcomed me with open arms, and they were just absolutely incredible. So,
and
he
actually said he would pay for it. He would pay, you know, he was so generous, but you didn't need it because you're in a country that's very advanced as far as taking care of health needs as opposed to this one I'm in. But that's incredible that he sort of suggested that he would help pay for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I started touring with him just after so many back-to-back treatments, and I just hit a point where all the treatments had failed.
Yeah.
And I just started this tour, and my specialists had been telling me to get my head around the fact that I wasn't going to survive.
Right. And, that's incredible that they did that.
Yeah, they'd run out of options. We'd exhausted all the avenues of treatment. Word got around in the band, and Michael sort of heard on the grapevine what I was going through and summoned me to his dressing room after a gig and just asked me to tell him all about it. And he said, well, what are you doing now if you've run out of options? And I said, well, I think my mum was looking into some treatments in Greece. I'd sent some blood samples to somewhere in Germany. I was looking at some treatments in Mexico that combined nutrition with chemotherapy. Lots of experimental drugs. Michael said, he asked me how much these kind of things cost. And he said, if you ever need, please just give me the bill. And I said,
wow.
I was just overwhelmed with that kind of support.
Because that's a serious
thankfully
bill,
I never did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thankfully I never had to. But just that kind of, that kind of support from someone who is able to do that kind of thing. It's just amazing. And I've stayed in touch. He's a very, very good friend of mine. I've stayed in touch with him. He's actually, unfortunately, quite poorly at the moment.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Physically or his just the voice?
I think he had a brain tumor removed.
Oh, no.
It affects one in two of us now.
Yeah.
In the world. So it's so common. Unfortunately, my family have all been affected by it as well.
Oh, of course. And there is rays of hope throughout the whole thing. And towards the end, I was going to ask, but here we are veering off the planned schedule happily. And we'll combine a couple of things. Tell me about what's the latest on the CD30 drug that starts with a B. And I wrote it down. I couldn't find it.
The first clinical trial I went through was anti CD30, which it basically it's a treatment that goes in the bloodstream, but it lands on the tumors where a certain protein exists. So it doesn't exist anywhere else in the body, but it lands on the tumors and then releases a treatment much, much stronger directly onto the tumors.
Directed.
So the drug, the first drug clinical trial I went through was Medarex CD30, which coincided with the protein that existed on my tumors. And my specialist said, this is interesting because I did respond a little bit to it.
Right. That one failed, but it had in the midst of it a good response to one portion.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So all the other treatments that I'd been through, I did respond to everything. But the specialist always would say, that's failed, that's failed, that's failed. And it was just countless treatments, stem cell transplants, chemotherapies. I exhausted everything. And it was just failed, 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 failed. But then when I slightly responded to this clinical trial, they were like, okay, it's failed, but it looks like this is the way we've got to treat you. So that was kind of, a glimmer of hope. And unfortunately, there was nothing around. There was nothing available.
Right.
Just said, if anything gets invented and comes along, then if you're willing, we'll try it out on you. And the second clinical trial was really bizarre. And I was locked in a lead-lined room for 9 days and injected with this highly radioactive drug. And a man with a Geiger counter came to my doorway every day, pointed this Geiger counter at me. It was very, very strange. Yeah. But I mean, the clinical trials are.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Exactly that, the trials.
Things that came out of that, and then I want to get back to the radioactive thing. Things that came out of that, I found the word brentuximab. Is that how you say it?
Yeah. So that was the last clinical trial I went through.
The last one. Yeah.
And that got me to remission and shocked every specialist.
Wow.
Because they repeatedly told me for 5 years that I wasn't going to make it. But brentuximab, it was the first drug to be FDA approved in over 40 years, 4-0,
wow.
40 years for Hodgkin's lymphoma. And for
amazing.
Me to land at that point
yeah.
to get that drug. Yeah, unbelievable.
We get that there's a plan here for Carol Jarvis. There's a plan and a destiny, and you're doing all kinds of things besides music, one of which is helping to bring that drug to the market, really. I mean, you showed such success, and now it's going to hopefully be something great for everybody.
Yeah,
start of something.
It was going to be struck off the Cancer Drugs Fund because it's so expensive, extremely expensive.
Yeah.
And I went with the Lymphoma Action Charity, one other person from the charity, and went to the House of Parliament and campaigned to, the House of Parliament. And I was literally in the House of Parliament telling them, you cannot do this because you need to save lives. If it wasn't for that drug, I wouldn't be here to tell my tale at all. And thankfully it got saved, and it's on the Cancer Drugs Fund. It is in circulation, and people are receiving this drug and saving lives. It's amazing.
See, this is why I constantly, in talking about you, refer to angels getting their wings, because that's just another case of the ultimate activism on your part that made something incredible happen, not only for you, but also for so many others. And that's incredible. Well,
you can't put a price on life.
No.
Everyone deserves a chance.
Absolutely. Well, we can segue this right back to one of the band leaders. So you're radioactive, and you're going to get a picture with Sting. Tell me about that one. That's such a cool story.
Oh, yeah, it's just bizarre. So I was busy touring with Seal, and I think I did six years with Seal. And I had one phone call on a day off from someone that I knew that worked for Universal, the record label. Saying, I need some musicians booking for a tour and recording with Sting. I was like,
wow,
did you say Sting?
Right? That's a phone call there.
Yeah. And so I was the fixer. So I had to book all the musicians. And I said, is there a trombone part? And he said, yes, there's a trombone part. And yes, you can book yourself to play.
Chart? Did you have to write the horn parts for his pieces, or?
No, that was already written. Yeah, it was all written already. I can't remember who the American musical director was, but yeah, he came with all the parts.
Cool.
And I booked all the string players as well. It was stunning, stunning music.
He's one of my favorites.
Just incredible. So focused and musical, just incredible. Started this second clinical trial where I was locked in a lead line room. And so I finished this clinical trial. And when you leave, they say, well, you're still quite radioactive, so you've got to stay away from everyone, 2 meters away from everyone for the next 2 months. Even longer for pregnant women, you've got to stay further away from them for an extra month after that, because your radioactivity is still going to be coming down. So when my parents picked me up, they had a Land Rover, so they sat in the front and I sat in the very back.
Sure.
Wheelbase, trying to stay as far away from people as possible. And it was the next week I went on tour with Sting. So I was like, well, I've got to sit on stage. I've got to travel with people. So I had to tell everyone around me, look, this is my situation. And every single person said, I don't care.
Wow.
We were halfway through the tour, and Sting was having some photos taken with people, so I thought, I really want to get my photos taken with Sting.
Of course.
So I went and asked him, can I get my photo taken? I said, yeah, yeah, sure. And I said, yeah, but I've got to tell you, I'm radioactive, so I'm not meant to be close to you. And he went, okay. He just said, come here, give me a hug.
Oh, good for him. With him.
I think he must have just thought I was quite strange.
Right, right. You don't get that every day. I take a picture, but I'm radioactive, so. So I'm thinking all kinds of crazy things in mind, like they didn't need a spotlight for you because you glowed naturally from the radioactivity or.
Well, actually, I remember halfway through this clinical trial, they sent me for a nuclear scan. And there was another person going through. There were just two of us in London and another two people in Perth in Australia having this trial. That was it. There's four people in the whole world.
Wow.
And this guy, I didn't even know there was another lead line room next to my lead line room. And he was having the same treatment. And I saw him on the way down. We went to the scan and he was coming back from the scan.
Yeah.
And he said, make sure you get a look at the scan when you come out. So I'm like, why? And he said, you're literally glowing from the inside outwards. Yeah.
Literally you really glowing. Were. It wasn't. Oh, yeah. Oh man. That's incredible. That's crazy. Yeah. Beyond incredible. I thought in listening to some of your story, I'd have to write down some descriptive words because, you know, you run out after incredible, epic, amazing, inspirational. You start running out of words, but that is quite literally incredible. I'd be in so much trouble if I didn't ask about Taylor Swift. What was that experience like? And were you playing in the horn section? I mean, you and Chad LB or somebody who was it, a horn section or your keyboards or both? Or
no, it was actually an orchestra behind her. Yeah. So
really the whole orchestra,
just a one-off. Yeah.
Oh, so, I see.
Just a one-off thing.
Did she speak to people or just ushered in and then taken away?
Yeah. I mean, she was really friendly. She said hi to everyone and I mean, they don't stick around very long when you're doing one of these big, it was a big, huge TV show. So.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So that's, wow. Well, so many wonderful experiences, through music. And it's just so inspirational and amazing to hear you talk about. Once again, on the podcast, everybody has to go to your podcast. That's required. And hear this incredible story, because at the end of the day, it's incredibly inspirational. And one of the things is that you talk about how music and therefore trombone playing saved your life, really.
Yeah.
Or it was a huge, huge part of it.
I mean, it was... I think 2005, so really shortly into my journey, I had radiotherapy to try and get the tumors in between my lungs, which were the really stubborn tumors.
Right.
There was like a rectangle on my chest where they did radiotherapy from the front and from the back. And it was just like a sunburnt area. And I remember seeing a lung specialist.
Yes.
Before we did this this radiotherapy, and they said, well, yeah, unfortunately we're going to clip both of your lungs, so you're going to lose 20-25% lung capacity. Can't do anything about that. That's going to be permanent. And I was like, hang on a minute.
Right.
I'm a trombone player. I use my lungs for a living. I need the full capacity.
Yeah.
And they just said, this is your life. You got to forget about that.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Okay. Went ahead with the radiotherapy, and I really did notice a difference when I carried on working as much as I could throughout the whole time, but I really, really noticed it, especially sat in an orchestral section, playing things like, Mahler, Shostakovich, the Planets,
right.
Things where you've really got to sustain a long chord. I just couldn't do it. Mm. But I kept working. I kept playing the trombone, and fast forward to 2011, and I'd finally just got to remission. So 2005 to 2011, I carried on working. I was going through loads and loads of failed treatments in that time. But 2011 got to remission, and they said, well, from a clinical trial getting to remission, we don't know how long that remission will last because it's an experimental drug. It could come back tomorrow. It could come back in 2 weeks' time. So what we need to do is find an unrelated bone marrow donor for you to basically take out your immune system, put his immune system in, and then hopefully if it works, and there's some real risks with that, some mortality rates that I had to talk about. Mm-hmm. And they said, if it works, you could live to a ripe old age. So they gave me a month to decide whether to go for this transplant or not. And it was a 30% survival rate.
Just even to do the transplant could cause that, right?
Yeah. So I got to remission. I've got no cancer, but now I've got to risk my life.
Yeah.
Just to try and have a future. And so I said, well, I'm just going to have to give it a go. And I mean, I go into real detail on my podcasts, but
yes, and
I went through some lung function tests just to check that I was going to be strong enough to cope with the transplant.
Right.
And it was something I was worried about because I've lost all this lung capacity from radiotherapy. So they put me in for this lung function test, and it's very strange. They put you in a room, a clip on your nose, a tube in your mouth, and they suck all the air out of the room and tell you to breathe.
Whoa.
And it's quite frightening, but it tests how strong your lungs are.
Right.
And I came back and got the results. They said my lungs were working at 102%.
Wow. And
all of my specialists said, well, it's the trombone. It's absolutely the trombone has kept you alive. The trombone has enabled you to go through this bone marrow transplant and basically consolidate the remission and give you a future. So yeah, I've got the trombone to thank for being alive.
Wow, you literally can say the trombone saved your life. That's unbelievable. Well, and this was going to be at the end, so I'll just bring this right around here because we are talking about it. The moment on your podcast, spoiler alert for everybody who's going to listen to it, which needs to be everybody, because it's just incredibly, it's riveting, you know, story. It really is. At the end of it, the moment where St. Thomas from Berlin, you have his DNA, his blood cells, and they say, yeah, they might be contaminated. It could kill you. And you say something like, and then I'm just paraphrasing here, something like, well, maybe we shouldn't. I said, nope, you have no immune system. You have to do it. You're going to die without it. You might die with it. What is that moment even like? How can people even begin to understand?
Yeah, so, I mean, you basically go through intensive chemotherapy for 8 days where they count down to day zero.
Yeah.
And all the intensive chemotherapy will get rid of my immune system, so there's nothing there. So day zero is when I receive the cells. And in that countdown of 8 days, my donor over in Germany, I don't know at this point who he is at all. It's completely unknown to me. He's having injections to boost his blood count. So he's got the most amount of cells to donate. So on the donation day, he has a needle in one arm, takes out all the what they need, and the rest of what they don't need goes back into the other arm. And he went back to work that afternoon. And these cells go through some tests, and then they go into an ice container with a courier, and it's hand luggage on a plane straight to my hospital, to my bedside. And then as soon as it arrives, it goes into a huge syringe. I've got a Hickman line in my chest. One half of it goes straight into my heart, and the other half sticks out of my chest where they connect the syringe, and they slowly push the syringe in, and it literally goes straight to my heart and then pumps around my body.
And you're watching that go in.
And I'm wide awake. Yeah. So when you say a transplant, you don't really expect to be awake, but
right,
so people were saying good luck in your operation. I'm like, yeah, it's not really like that. Yeah. But anyway, before the cells arrived, there was a phone call from Germany over to my hospital saying that they got some tests run on these cells before they came over. Mm. And a team of microbiologists came into my room, and no one's allowed in the room. It's completely airlocked. You've got to have it completely sanitized, completely clean.
Because you have no immune system, right?
You're exactly.
Gone. Yeah.
Yeah. A speck of dust. You literally can't risk anything. But this team of microbiologists came in, all masks and aprons and hats and gloves. And I was like, what's going on? What's going on? Yeah. This isn't, I know this isn't right. Hmm. And they said, well, some test results have come back and we think the cells are contaminated. And I said, what do you mean?
That's the showstopper right there.
Yeah, they can't be contaminated. They said there's a chance of toxoplasmosis.
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, what? And I said, straight away, that's going to kill me.
Right, right, yeah.
So I said, I'm not going to have the transplant. That's it. It's over. I'm done.
Mm.
And I said, well, actually, it's too dangerous now to not give you the cells. You need the cells. You're going to have to go ahead. We will run some tests when they arrive.
Yeah.
But those results won't come back for 2 or 3 days. You need to have this transplant. You need to go ahead. So, yeah, I was just watching this syringe going in thinking, it's my lethal injection.
Right, right.
Literally that, yeah.
And it, that's the incomprehensible thing that, you know, people say, I can't even imagine that. I mean, you can try, but that's something that unless you've experienced it to know it, that moment must have felt like.
Yeah.
I can't imagine
terrifying.
Yes, absolutely terrifying.
I think there will never be a moment in my life, hopefully,
yes.
that will ever be as terrifying as that.
Let's hope not. That's, you've paid your dues, as they say, as far as terrifying moments. My goodness. Well, end result is that, how is Carol doing today?
I'm good, yeah. I'm almost 13 years in remission now.
Oh, so, congratulations.
Yeah, unbelievable, really. And I'm still in touch with Thomas, my donor, who I share DNA with.
I know. It's so cool that they eventually let you guys meet each other. And that's what an amazing bond that is.
Yeah.
A 21st century bond indeed. Well, we have about 17 or so minutes left. So I want to do the world's fastest lightning round, because now I want to make sure we enjoy some music. And I call it the lightning round because I've picked some pieces of yours that I really enjoyed. And that was easy to do because you've got a lot of them. I really enjoy the body of work that you have out there. So I picked up, folks, I didn't download, I purchased her music. So yes, that's what must happen. Everybody listening here, don't just enjoy the downloads, purchase. And you too can get some wings for angels when you do that. Give the people money. Anyway, let's see. I've got them in order because I don't know if we'll have time to do all of them, but so let's try. The first one is a surprise choice. And it comes from Trinity. How did you pronounce the second name again?
Trinity Laban.
Laban. Okay. Conservatoire, which is so much cooler than in the U.S. we say conservatory.
Yeah.
Conservatoire. So much cooler. Oh, man. At Trinity on the website, I saw this one. This is the only one I haven't purchased yet. But a live performance, Trombone Festival, of an arrangement of called I Think of You. And absolutely love that. And it says that it was Russ Garcia did it originally, but you adapted it. What was the process of adapting and arranging it for, do you pronounce it, Ned Sim Light? Is that the ensemble that was?
So I was just flown out to the Netherlands to help promote a trombone festival that was going to happen. And they had this string quartet in the Netherlands and a rhythm section. And they said, do you want to form something with them? And said, yeah, okay, great. So they filmed it, and that was just to promote a trombone festival. But it's the video went down quite well on YouTube.
It sure did. It sounds great. Was that a one take situation, just a live here it is?
Yeah, there was no audience. It was just a camera crew and this group, and the film crew actually ended up being really, really good friends of mine. And they're now, I introduced them to the International Trombone Festival, and they've been the film crew on every International Trombone Festival since 2014 now, I think. So,
wow, that's wonderful.
Yeah, and I met them there, and it was just the way they produced and the way they worked. And I was like, they're fantastic. Mm. They're really good guys.
Well, talking about notes that are an arch nemesis of mine, it's the high E flat, and that is featured beautifully on that piece. You slide right up to an E flat with slide vibrato. It's gorgeous. I recommend
one of my favorite notes, that is.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It really does sound like it. I prefer even a F sharp or a F more so. For some reason, the E flat wants to fight me. I'll play the E flat and my horn will say, might I suggest an E natural? I think that would be nice. No, that's not what I had in mind. So yeah, that's beautiful and a nice arrangement. The strings are gorgeous. Great recording. I really enjoyed hearing that. So let's all hear that. Here is a little snippet of the Russell Garcia arrangement and Carol Jarvis adaptation of I Think of You, featuring Carol Jarvis on the solo trombone with the Ned Sim Light string ensemble. Doggies, that's how you play a high E flat, folks. Man, just gorgeous. I think Irby Green, Bill Watrous, Dick Nash, anybody would be proud of that one. And wow, beautiful. Well, let's grab a couple more. My favorite, Radioactive. So I've got some questions, and then I'll let you talk about it. Great chart, composed. I want to know about the orchestration and composition process. Here's my question. It's such a groovy, danceable groove for something that we now know it comes from a very intense situation. I thought that was an interesting choice. Jerry Hay type horns. Tell me about the horns. And were you on bass trombone as well, or what's going on there?
Yeah, so I teamed up with a producer. I sort of provided a few horn lines with him for some of his stuff in the past, and I liked, again, I sort of followed him on social media, liked the way he worked, and I thought, well, when I hit 10 years in remission, I thought I want to mark this moment, because I wasn't meant to live, but now I'm 10 years in remission. That's a decade of going through cancer and now a decade of being in remission. I've got to mark this with something.
Now it makes sense, the celebration of it. Yeah,
so there's all the tracks are related to what I went through. So The Risk Is Taken was all about signing on the dotted line, going for that bone marrow transplant at the end. There's Fusion, which is the fusion of my donor and me, the DNA and all that coming together. And Radioactive is that clinical trial. In My Veins is all about the cancer in my veins, all the treatments going in my veins, the poison, everything, being a blood cancer. Right. So Radioactive was, I wanted to be able to play these kind of things live as well. So I had to really think about looping and So looping all the different layers of trombones. I think there's 9 trombone parts on Radioactive, and also being able to play the keys as well. And
it's
the YouTube,
a great sound. It's
YouTube
a great
clips. Yeah, right. That'll explain how I loop it all. And so also when In My Veins, the title track, I use some sort of percussive sounds of the trombone, sort of hitting the mouthpiece.
You'll see
that again on the YouTube videos of those two tracks will sort of explain how it all loops together and layers up.
Oh, that's cool. Well, that's worth checking out. And it all comes from the project, the title track, the project In My Veins. Isn't that cool? That is a little bit of the track Radioactive from the project In My Veins. That's my favorite, man. I love that one. Great horn stuff, too. and Carol all the way up to a high F or something, man. That was great. Radioactive. All right, back to the lightning round. Yeah. Well, how about that tune itself? That is another one I really, really enjoyed. What would you call, not that it needs a style name, but danceable fusion, dance groove?
Yeah, it's kind of, I always thought that, well, trombone players, they generally release a classical album or a jazz album. Mm-hmm. And no one's really doing much of anything else. So I thought, well, why can't trombones be connected with electronic music, house music, dance music?
Ah, there we are. House music, sure.
So, yeah, house and dance. I mean, that actually ended up, I think Radioactive and In My Veins ended up at the top of the charts in Singapore, on the dance charts. So I don't
great.
Really, if I put a label on it, I'd say dance or house, but you kind of, it's when it gets into the charts or when it gets playlisted somewhere. Mm-hmm. That's where you find out actually it's dance.
Right,
it's on
right.
the dance charts, it's on the house charts, it's on the jazz charts. So that's when you kind of find out what genre it is.
Well, it's delightful. And as I mentioned, doesn't need a label or a genre. It's just cool music. But listening to it as a house or dance track, it's very clever, I think, as to when the trombone sound comes in, you know, so it's the, you know, more stereotypical music of that genre. And then, bam, here's trombone. And for all of us trombonists, it's like, what is this? How cool is this? For the rest of the world, civilians, I wonder what they're thinking. What is this sound? did you think about it like, I better save it for this part? Or was it just a natural composition that way?
I think it was kind of natural. I kind of wanted to get everything started. Keyboards, pedals, percussion. There's all sorts of different layers going on to be able to then layer the trombone on top. But yeah, doing it live is just a bit... I mean, a few people have asked me to do a whole set of it now and put on a gig.
Yeah,
but I'm not sure my brain can cope with remembering literally everything.
Bring Jacob Collier out with you, and I'm sure he'd find a way to loop it.
That would be helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, before we get to the last piece in the lightning round, let's hear a little bit of the title track. This is "In My Veins," featuring Carol Jarvis, and composed by Carol Jarvis. Nice. Very cool ending on that one. That's In My Veins by Carol Jarvis. Title track of the same project, which I highly recommend. Go to caroljarvis.com and purchase that entire project. All right, let's go back to the final portion of the lightning round. It's just wonderful stuff. Well, I'll end the lightning round with something that I'm not pandering here. I really did think it was a masterpiece of arranging and orchestration, and that was your title track from the project Smile. And I think that's just a beautiful arrangement. Very poignant treatment, you know, the hope coming out of hopelessness. It really comes across to me. So tell us about arranging and orchestrating your thoughts in that piece.
So yeah, the album Smile came about when I was ill and when I was being told I wasn't going to survive. And a very dear friend of mine, conductor, arranger, came to me and said, "Well, let's do something. Let's do a recording for charity, for a cancer charity." So that's what this album was all about.
That's right.
Every musician gave their time for free. The studio gave us a very, very low price, which was amazing. We just piled into the studio for 2 days and produced 16 tracks, which is kind of, didn't have much time to do it all.
But
all the arrangements were done specially for me. And my dear friend Rod did this arrangement of Smile. It's so clever the way he did it, because there's kind of a dark drone type piano part underneath the bottom. And he described that as that's the cancer, that's the underlying darkness that is going on.
Wow.
And it all gets everything, the strings and everything gets more and more busy, and it's just all overpowering. But the trombone just sits on the top, and I'm almost making light of the whole situation. Mm. And there's a few jokey little lines that I play.
Right.
And that was exactly how I coped with going through cancer for such a long time. I think there was a lot of determination and denial going on at the same time. So you've got to find a way to escape. You've got to find a way to laugh. You've got to find a way to live still. Mm. And that's what that track just sums it all up. And when Rod said, "What should we call the album?" I said, "Well, there's one thing I'm doing throughout all of this, and that's smiling. Right. You've got to carry on smiling." So that was why it was the title track. Yeah.
It really, really comes across. It really, really does. Without knowing any of the programmatic ideas of the arranger, that's not surprising. I enjoyed that underlying drone, and all of that comes across so well. It does what an arrangement should do, I think.
Yeah, it gives you goosebumps.
It does. It really does. Please, everybody, buy that project as well. In fact, here we are post-production again. I'll make a deal with you. I will play the entire track with just a little bit of me talking at the beginning to inspire you to buy the track. The deal is this. I'll play the whole thing because you need to hear this arrangement. But you need to go out and buy the album. Get the whole thing, man. The money goes towards cancer research, as Carol mentioned. So jump in, buy the whole thing, and it's at caroljarvis.com. Here is Smile.
Thank you.
That's a classic right there. I love all the funny stuff at the end, as Carol mentioned, laughing right into the face of adversity is one of the ways that she survived that crazy, crazy time in her life. Beautiful. Let's go back to the show. Let's talk about how they can get all this good stuff. CarolJarvis.com. Is the best way to do it, or is there another route that the listeners should
use?
Yeah,
probably. There's it's everywhere. It's all Apple, Spotify, mm-hmm. Bandcamp. I think Bandcamp's very good on Fridays. They give all the money to artists. They don't take a cut at all.
Oh, so. That's right, on Fridays, yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. So, yep, start with caroljarvis.com and then go to anywhere that you get good music. Same with her podcast, anywhere that you get your podcast. It's always fun to say that and listen to that. And just learn all that there is to learn about Carol Jarvis, and you'll be glad you did. And a lot of folks already know. When I told people that you were going to be the next guest, they were all excited and said, "Oh, she's the best. It's going to be great." And they didn't lie. Well, uh-huh. we'll leave with... you are finishing up your stint as the president of the International Trombone Association, or you're already done or about to be finished, or
I think it's 2023 to 2026.
So oh, you're in the midst of it. You're in the
right in the middle of it. Yeah.
Sorry about that. You've got a ways to go.
And I've been president of the International Trombone Festival since 2017, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, can't really remember. Yeah.
Well, good. We're going to have you with us for a couple more years. That's good news. Because Dave Bagnosch is waiting in the wings. We need to keep him away as long as possible. He's a friend, so I can say that. And thank you very much.
No, thank you. Absolutely amazing. You're a hero of mine. So,
Well, absolutely. I appreciate that so much. And you're a hero of mine. And I'm glad to have met you.
And you.
All right.
I hopefully see you at International Trombone Festival someday.
I hope so. Yes, absolutely. I hope so. I will try to. It's at Dave's place this year, right?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
I'll try to make it down and check it out.
I will buy you a drink.
All righty. First, then the next three pints are on me. Woo! Was that fun or what, everybody? And sadly, that concludes this episode of the Leadology podcast. Stay tuned for the next podcast episode coming up, where our guest artist will be the legendary Michael Deese. That's right, Mr. Blues on the Corner himself. All right, we will see you then. In the meantime, enjoy a little bit of the Front Range here, my fusion group playing our theme song, The Vinny Paradox. It has to do with what happens when you throw a 3-4 bar into the midst of a 4-4 progression. It turns the backbeat into downbeats. I know, right? Deep. You know it's deep. Trombone solo. Go get it, Stevie.
Is a production of Wiest World Productions 2024.